Thanks for downloading the Inner Time podcast. For more details about Inner Time and for our terms of use, please go to bbc.co.uk/radio4. I hope you enjoy the program. Hello. In 1745, in the port city of Liverpool in England, two reading societies based in well-known coffee shops and taverns formed a subscription library which they advertised to, quote, all gentlemen and ladies who desire to encourage the progress of useful knowledge. With this, a new means of sharing information, the subscription library was born. Unlike the public libraries of the present day, access was generally restricted to members. Before this, lead miners in Lanarkshire, Scotland, had founded a reading society resembling a subscription library in that it had a permanent collection. Not many years later, two other subscription libraries appeared in Scotland, notably the Society Library of Dumfries, 1745, and the Public Library of Kelso in 1751. Although some subscription libraries still exist today, the phenomenon is primarily associated with 18th century United Kingdom. We will discuss the history and core characteristics of the subscription library with Mary Bradford, Professor of History at the University of Cambridge, Elle MacDonald, Professor of the Cultural Studies Department at the University of St. Andrews, and Ivy Correa, Associate Professor of the Faculty of Information Studies at the University of Liverpool. Mary Bradford, can you start us off by telling us what exactly is meant by the term subscription libraries?
Well, subscription libraries, also sometimes called proprietary libraries, are institutions that we first started seeing around the mid-18th century and became very popular in various parts of Britain by the first quarter of the 19th century. Library subscribers would often pay a fee for admission as a member. This was typically around a guinea or sometimes more. There were another yearly subscription fee to maintain their membership. Members would also be shareholders in the library, and their fees would be put towards the purchase of the library's books. What's interesting, and what sets subscription libraries apart from circulating libraries at the time, is that the democratic nature in which not just the books in the collection, but also the librarians who worked there were chosen. Likewise, reading societies were also similar institutions, but they were more informal and sold off their collections every year to pay for new books.
So unlike libraries of today, where books are free to the public, the foundation of what subscription libraries is built upon the fees paid by members and texts required using these fees?
Yes, exactly.
Were some years more successful than others in terms of the number of members? Could you provide us with some statistics or the gist of the financial situation of these libraries?
Well, the number of members definitely depended on each library. Some libraries, like the Kelso Library, hovered around a steady number of 65 to 70 members over a 100-year period, while other libraries, such as the Leeds Library, which still exists today, had as many as 450 members by 1791, and it continued to grow from there. Of course, these numbers are fluid. I would say that the period between the mid-18th century and the mid-19th century are when we see the most subscription libraries cropping up. After 1850, there's still some growth, but it's not as significant. And then once we enter into the 20th century, the decline becomes even more considerable. I should also note that these libraries did not appear uniformly across Britain, and there was definitely more libraries appearing in England and Scotland, which had well over 500 subscription libraries by 1850, as opposed to Wales, which only had 6 subscription libraries that we know of. Now, the financial situation of each library varied greatly, and there were a number of factors that contributed to the success of the library. Libraries with a low or falling number of subscribers had difficulty in sustaining themselves. To give an example, we can look at the York Subscription Library, which was struggling with rising costs. In 1825, the library earned £670 and spent £270 of that on new books. By 1893, the library's membership had fallen and the library's income was just less than £500, and only roughly 100 of that was spent on books.
I'm sure much of the audience is wondering, as am I, about the sociocultural context in which these subscription libraries came to be. Elle MacDonald, given your expertise in this area, could you briefly comment?
Right, so I'll just provide a bit of a background. At this period in the UK, the 18th and 19th centuries, following the Industrial Revolution, there came the emergence of the middle class. That is to say, a class composed of professionals situated between the upper and working classes. The very culture of the UK was shifting at this time and becoming increasingly commercial and trade-oriented, which gave rise to leisure time, which then leads us back to subscription libraries.
Wonderful. Could you tell us about the types of individuals who formed these libraries?
Subscribers were largely men who belonged to this new emerging middle class and included professionals such as doctors and lawyers, but also merchants, factory owners, and even members of the church. There are also some cases of female membership, which included wives and daughters of male subscribers. For example, the Portico Library in Manchester is believed to have had the first female subscribers in the 1870s, and women occasionally served as informal librarians in other libraries within the United Kingdom. Now, perhaps one of the most interesting features of the individuals who created these libraries is that they were not academics, as one might assume, but were various local community members. In fact, subscription libraries appear to have flourished in northern England and the lowlands of Scotland, which were somewhat removed from the scholarly circles of the south, such as Oxford, Cambridge, and London. So although members may have been physically isolated from these academic spheres, the subscription libraries they formed allowed them to engage with the popular text, as well as the ideologies and thinking of the period. The materials they acquired were then varied, including texts from a broad range of subjects such as science, politics, religion, history, and so forth.
So just to clarify, these materials were acquired upon request of the members themselves?
Yes, and for the most part, the materials shied away from any political or religious biases. So this variety of materials is largely due to the democratic foundations of the subscription library. Each subscriber was able to contribute suggestions for acquisitions. The committee would then consider these suggestions and vote on what to purchase with their funds. The acquired texts would then circulate throughout the library's members, and finally, members would meet to exchange ideas and discuss the texts, participating in a local community of thinkers.
That seems like quite a peaceful community, though I'm sure there were many difficulties to be faced, finances being one of them. Ivy Priya, I'm wondering if the subscription librarian tasks or the library system is similar to the ones we have today.
As the 19th century progressed into the 20th century, committee members influenced the direction and outlook of subscription library greatly. Members usually had control over the selection and other matters. Less professional librarians were employed and given decisive responsibility. Rather, part-time booksellers and unqualified librarians were increasingly sought by subscription libraries. And not surprisingly, these unqualified librarians were also ill-paid, about £40 a year. They were expected to enforce library rules rigorously, such as finding overdue books, and could be punished if they failed in any respect. Furthermore, the library was open daily for 6 hours, beginning the 19th century. Some subscription libraries that survived into the 20th century had huge collections. In addition to satisfy the needs of contemporary subscribers, these subscription libraries were in interest of acquisitions lasting values. For example, Birmingham Library had 80,000 volumes, Leeds Library had 60,000, and Liverpool Library had 98,400. The essence of this subscription library was that acquisition should be selective and accumulating to serve as a repository of the vast collection of contemporary and older works for the whole society.
Mayor Bradford, let's come back to you. These libraries seem to have formed under the desire of wanting to know more in the idea of self-improvement. Chosen books furthered learning in political and historical subjects rather than promoting fiction and popular novels. In this sense, how did subscription libraries benefit society?
Yes, well, subscription libraries were appearing in Britain as Europe was going through the Enlightenment, and people were seeking more knowledge than ever before. In conjunction with this was the growing book trade and the advancements being made in publishing. Suddenly, there were more books than anybody could ever hope to buy, and libraries made it easier to have access to a large collection of materials. To answer your question of how subscription libraries benefited society, I think it's useful to look at the subscription library as an associational institution, where people would voluntarily come together and form organized groups over a common interest, in this case, books.
Well, books were expensive, so I can see that subscription libraries were an efficient way to spread knowledge and information, since members could collectively chip in, pardon my lack of a better phrase, and collectively read and share books. Would you agree, Ellen McDonald?
Precisely. These libraries allowed members to have access to an array of texts and materials which may not have been available to them otherwise. As to the topic of the subscription system's importance or benefit to society, it seems as though members were concerned with permanence. What I mean by permanence in this context is that the subscribers were not only collecting materials for the interest and benefit of current members, but for the subsequent generations of members. Members actively wanted to create an enduring and expanding collection of knowledge and maintain a place of communal learning that would extend in time. This idea of permanence then played a role in the selection process as members sought to acquire materials for their collection that they believed to be of value for future readers. Even though subscription libraries ultimately did not last the test of time, I'm inclined to say that their concern for future readership and self-improvement was a fascinating approach to operating a library.
So, Well, yes, I just wanted to add on to that. These libraries did not just cater to the enlightened reader, but they also created a sense of community among members, or as one such organization put it, friendship and good neighborhood.
Well, there you go. Subscription libraries may seem like a thing from the past, but they are still relevant and provided a framework and a sense of community to public libraries today. Ivy Korea, could you tell us a bit more about how these libraries evolved with time and where they are now?
The rise of free public libraries and local branch libraries had led to a decline of subscription libraries in the late 19th century. Many subscription libraries had been taken over by government and become public libraries with the Public Libraries Act in 1850s. Only 12 subscription libraries survived at the end of the 20th century. Today, in the United Kingdom, the Leeds Library is the oldest subscription library that is still surviving, and the Liverpool Athenaeum is the most expensive subscription library. Although public libraries provide a wealth of free resources for the public, the main reason that people still pay and join subscription library today is the feeling of being part of a city's heritage. Subscription libraries are more than stacked up books. Rather, they offer a comfortable space for the joy of reading among busy shopping areas in the city within historical buildings. When people pick up a book and huddle in a quiet corner in a subscription library, it's an escape from the bustling city life. While different people prefer different types of libraries, both public libraries and subscription libraries today aim to foster the engagement with books and spread of knowledge.
Well, that's all the time we have for today. Thank you all very much. That was terrific. Thank you, Ivy Korea, Mary Bradford, and Ellen McDonald. Next week, we'll be talking about library censorship and intellectual freedom. Thank you all for listening.